Okay, so thanks for setting this up, and it's a real pleasure to be here at Perimeter. This is my first visit as a DRC, and hope to come here frequently and talk with all of you and have interactions and maybe even collaborations. The talk today will be about topological phases. I've kind of qualified that with integer topological phases. I'll explain what I mean by that, essentially analogs of the integer quantum Hall effect. And what we've been realizing recently is that even with this restriction, there are an enormous number of very interesting phases, and we have only begun to scratch the surface of these kind of states. Okay, so I'll focus on two aspects. What happens when you think of quantum entanglement in these states, and more recent work on interaction effects, and the talk after mine by Senthil will also develop some of this these themes. he cleverly arranged that I would be the first speaker to give you the introduction and stuff like that, and he'll tell you all of the interesting physics. He'll tell you all the jokes. I may tell some jokes too, but they may be sort of inadvertent jokes. Okay, so to kind of contrast this with more conventional phases, so we all know that in condensed matter physics, by and large, we talk about phases that are distinguished by spontaneous symmetry breaking. Okay, so a solid, for example, spontaneously breaks the translation symmetry. So you can distinguish a solid from a liquid or a gas. Superfluids break a slightly more exotic kind of symmetry, the symmetry of phase rotations of particles. And of course, magnets, they break the isotropy of space, the spins orient along some direction, and they break time reversal symmetry. And for a long time, it was thought that these are really the distinctions between phases. You have two phases that have the same symmetry, they are the same phase. Okay, or if you see some distinction between them, like we see between, say, a liquid and a gas, that distinction can be erased by going to some other conditions. For example, if you put liquid water under sufficiently high pressure and steam under the same pressure, at some point you can go continuously from liquid to gas. Okay? So there's no symmetry distinction, and in principle, there's really no distinction between the phases. Okay, but what we have realized actually many decades back, but now this is a point that's being made with a lot more force, is that in fact there are other distinctions between phases. States of matter can be different at the level of topology and can be different even though they share the same symmetry. And the viewpoint I'll take in this talk is that we'll be interested in looking at what are the different types of phases possible in nature, what are their properties, and I'll leave for another time the question of how we would try to realize these phases. I think Senthil will talk a little bit about that. But it's kind of interesting to note that you can use this sort of Landau way of thinking about phases and classify all the different types of solids in nature. Okay, all the different types of crystals. There are 230 different types of crystals in terms of symmetry. In fact, they're all realized in nature. Okay, so we'll take that as a hopeful sign that nature will be kind and we'll find the phases we predict. Okay, so so one point that I'll sort of elaborate on as we go along is that in all of these cases, you can distinguish symmetry broken phases by evaluating a certain local operator simply in the ground state wave function. Okay, so let's say we're thinking about zero temperature states that are given by a ground state wave function. There's a way to just inspect that wave function using a local order operator, that's this order parameter, and diagnose which phase we're in. Okay, so we'll ask the analogous question for these phases, phases that are distinguished at the level of topology. If I give you the ground state wave function and nothing else, right? I won't give you the excitation spectrum or won't give you its response to external fields. I simply give you the ground state wave function. Can you tell which topological phase it's in? Okay, we'll see that the answer to that question appears to be yes and is related to the entanglement of these wave functions. Okay, so to talk about phases that differ at the level of of topology. So for example, if I think of a simple state of matter, a band insulator, where the electrons occupy all of these valence bands, there's an energy gap, and there are no electrons in the conduction band. So band insulators, according to the symmetry breaking paradigm, should all be the same if they have the same symmetry. Okay, that is the old old viewpoint, that if I have two phases that share the same symmetry, they should be the same phase. Okay, and it turns out even for these very extremely simple sort of systems, there is a distinction between band insulators at the level of topology. Okay, and all of this physics can be seen simply with free fermions, and it's, of course, eminently tractable. Okay, so by the way, if there are any questions, feel free to ask. Okay, so to give you a very quick review of how topology can be used to distinguish between phases, as you know, topology characterizes a sort of coarse property of an object. So two objects that differ substantially like this are still the same from the point of view of topology, because you can go smoothly from one to the other. Okay, so all kinds of smooth deformations are allowed. But these pairs of objects are distinct, because to go from an orange to a donut, you have to do something singular. You have to punch a hole in that surface. Okay, and in fact, this topology of surfaces is very nicely characterized by a single number, the genus, which tells you how many handles that object has. Okay, and there's a very interesting observation due to Gauss, that you can integrate the curvature, a certain kind of curvature of this surface, over the entire surface, and it'll end up giving you the genus. Okay, so there's a way to figure out the topology of your surface by integrating some curvature. Okay, so you can see that this idea of topology, the fact that two objects that are smoothly connected are identified as the same, there's a very natural correspondence of that with phases of matter, right? So two systems, if I can smoothly go from one to the other without anything singular happening in between, without a phase transition, I would call the same phase. Okay, whereas if you have some singular thing like going from here to there, the analog of that for a state of matter is a phase transition, then they're really distinct phases.
On your general comments, sometimes phases, transitions happen by change of temperature. So in that case, you know, like melting or something like that.
Right.
So in that case, how can you talk about the ground state wave function?
Yeah, so for this, particular talk, I will only concentrate on zero temperature phases, states of matter at zero temperature. There's a natural extension to finite temperature of phases, but we'll really be interested in quantum effects. And for questions of principle, that typically means that you have to be at zero temperature. Okay, but a lot of the stuff that we know about in terms of classical phases and phase transitions, they have analogs at zero temperature. For example, if you take helium and you know, look at it at ambient pressure, go to very low temperatures, it's a superfluid. If you apply pressure, it becomes a solid. Okay, so you have that kind of phase diagram even at zero temperature if you vary some other parameter like pressure. Okay, so let's apply these ideas to band insulators. So this tells us perhaps there's a distinction between band insulators at the level of topology. And in fact, the first such example has been known for almost two decades. It's really the integer quantum Hall effect. Okay, so the integer quantum Hall effect is when you take electrons in a strong magnetic field, a two-dimensional layer of electrons in a strong magnetic field, you go to low temperatures, and it ends up you get these different states of matter, which differ in a quantity called the Hall conductance. Okay, so you can make an electrical measurement, apply a voltage and study the current perpendicular to your voltage. That turns out to be quantized in units of the fundamental constants to some integers. Okay, and obviously, if you have an integer characterizing your state, a state of the different integer must be a different phase. There's no way to go continuously from one integer to the other. Okay, so although in those days it was not discussed in this language, this essentially tells you that there are different states of band insulators that differ in terms of the Hall conductance. Okay, and in addition to that fact that they differ in terms of Hall conductance, the other property that they possess is that if you go to the edge of these states, you find that there are excitations that occur even at low energies. Okay, so in the bulk, deep inside one of these states, there are no excitations at low energies. It's like a band insulator with an energy gap, but the energy gap closes as you approach the edge, and you find that the edge state is rather unusual. It only propagates in one direction. Okay, so for the high energy physicists, it's a chiral fermion in 1+1 dimension. It's impossible to get a dispersion that looks like that in a purely one-dimensional system. Okay, so although the edge is one-dimensional effectively, the dispersion you get is impossible if you had a purely one-dimensional system and no bulk that was attached to it. Again, all of this physics, this topology, can be seen by a formula very analogous to the one we had before. You integrate some quantity, which is like a curvature. It's called the Chern flux. And if you integrate that over momentum space, over the Brillouin zone of the system, it ends up giving you this integer that distinguishes the phases. Okay, and that's really the integer that is this Hall conductance. Okay, so this has been known for a while, and recently people realized that there are analogs of these states which occur in less extreme conditions. You don't need to apply a very strong magnetic field or go to very low temperatures. In fact, certain solids can be in phases, in analogous phases, and it was theoretically first predicted that these phases would occur, and soon after, experiments discovered materials that actually live in these particular phases. Okay, and so these are the famous topological band insulators. Again, the bulk is gapped, but they have exotic surface states. There's a two-dimensional example, very much like the quantum Hall effect I showed before. There's also an example in three dimensions. The surface state over here is a Dirac cone, and it's impossible to get, it's known that it's impossible to get such a dispersion if you had a purely two-dimensional system, okay, with the time reversal symmetry. Okay, graphene, which is a two-dimensional system with Dirac nodes, has a pair of them. Here you just have one. Okay, and the new feature over here, compared to the previous example, is that it's important that you have a certain symmetry in order to define these phases. Okay, they're defined only in the presence, in this case, of time reversal symmetry. Okay, and shortly after this theoretical prediction, there were experiments that found various materials that were in this phase. So people did experiments looking at the surface states, and they showed that, in fact, the surface states have a single Dirac dispersion. It's clearly visible over here. Somewhat more detailed analysis shows the same for this particular surface state. So this is exactly what you would expect from these unusual phases. Okay, they have exotic surface states, and whereas in the bulk, they actually look like any other insulator. Okay, so it's really easy to miss these phases if you didn't know that there was something special at the surface. Okay, so in fact, people were working with these materials for a long time. So this bismuth telluride, the one I showed you the picture of just before, is actually extensively used as a thermoelectric, shows up in these PCR units where you want both heating and cooling at the same time. So this material was literally under people's noses. And until there was a prediction for what to look for, nobody actually went and did these experiments. Okay, so that's really a hallmark of these topological phases, somewhat unlike the symmetry broken phases we talked about before. Often the distinction between these states is rather subtle. Okay, and unless you knew what to look for, it would be hard to actually find these phases. Okay, and that also makes it interesting and challenging for theorists to come up and predict what are the essential characteristics of different types of topological phases. Okay, so that was a very quick introduction to these topological phases, and all of the types of topological phases I've talked about till now, all of them can be realized, in fact, with free fermion models. Okay, so even in the absence of interactions, you can have all of the essential physics. And it's rather surprising that even without interactions, you get such rich physics. Okay, so I'll talk about, term such states as integer topological phases, since they are analogs of the integer quantum Hall effect. Now, it turns out that this will be the subject of part two of my talk, that are actually interacting analogs of these phases as well. So although some of them are realized in the absence of interactions, sometimes interactions can be critical to realizing this set of phases. Okay, but there will still be a distinction. There will still be some meaning to this integer that I'm talking about, this integer topological phases. And it's good to contrast it with another set of topological phases that's been of great interest, which are fractional quantum Hall states, okay, or so-called gapped quantum spin liquids. Okay, so these also are topological phases. They're gapped states, which have no order of any kind, but they differ from your garden variety states and having some unusual physics. Okay, but the distinction over here is rather different. The physics of these fractional topological phases involve differences in the bulk of the system. Okay, so even inside the bulk of the system, you find excitations that carry fractional statistics, for example, in the context of this fractional quantum Hall effect, the Laughlin states, you get excitations that are anions that have statistics between fermions and bosons. Okay, and there are many other interesting properties. They carry fractional charge and so on. Okay, so all of these things are characterized by topological order in the sense that if I put these states on closed manifolds, like on a torus, you end up getting degeneracy of the ground state. Okay, so so that's one class of phases. And I want to point that out mainly because I won't be talking about these phases, at least in this talk. Okay, so they're extremely interesting phases, but a lot is known about them already. And we'll focus attention on states like this, where, for example, if you put these states on a closed manifold without edges, they have a unique ground state. Okay, so they don't have topological order. If you look inside the bulk of these phases, you don't have excitations that have funny statistics or anything like that. It's really at the surface that they differ from regular phases, and the fact that they have very unusual surface states. Okay, so the first question I'd like to ask is, if someone hands me a topological insulator wave function, okay, so I just give you the ground state wave function of a topological insulator, one of these topological phases, how do I tell? Okay, how do I diagnose the fact that this state is unusual? Okay, so we know that if I give you the complete Hamiltonian with the surface present, you can simply look at the spectrum of the excitations at the surface. Okay, and that will diagnose this phase. It will tell you there's some unusual physics going on. Okay, but it's an interesting question of principle and sometimes also important for finding these phases in numerics. How do I tell if I'm just given the ground state wave function? Yeah.
What about just some property of the solid that somehow internally is twisted up that you can point to and say, that's topologically ordered. Is there anything like that? In chiral P wave superconductors, you can sort of see you've got these, you know, pairs that are orbiting around whatever.
And yeah.
You can imagine that why, when you get to the surface, it has to resolve itself somehow.
Yes, yes.
So what about the insulators?
So, you know, for the chiral P-wave superconductor example you gave, so there are, you know, examples of these kind of states, even for superconductors, topological superconductors, where there are unusual edge states. And as you're saying, in the chiral P-wave, there are these Cooper pairs that rotate around each other. When they get to the edge, they end up giving you this edge state. Now, of course, we know that that's not a sufficient condition to get a topological superconductor. For example, if I had these particles very strongly bound to each other, forming molecules that had like a P-wave orbital, that wouldn't really have edge states. It's only this limit of weak pairing that they have edge states. But you know, if you want a sort of a pictorial idea of what is going on, at least for these two-dimensional topological insulators, the physics is rather similar. So you have, it only occurs in the presence of spin-orbit interactions, and the up-spin electron sees effectively a magnetic field, and the downspin electrons see an opposite magnetic field. And because of the magnetic field, they have the circular motion. And when they get to the edge, they kind of skip around and give you these edge states. The really non-trivial thing that was noticed by Charlie Kane and Jean Millet, so everyone kind of expected these kind of edge states, but you would think that since you have a right moving edge and a left moving edge from the upspin and the downspin electrons, in general, they would mix and end up giving you a gap. So they would, these counterpropagating edges would mix and split. But what they showed is that if you have time reversal symmetry, they don't do that. They're forbidden from doing that. And it relies very key, in a key way on the fact that time reversal symmetry is like a Cramer's transformation for electrons. It's an anti-unitary operator that squares to minus one. Yeah, so that property was used very much in order to argue that these, you know, this picture that you have about edge states actually survives even when you think about interactions between these oppositely moving edges. Any other questions? Okay, so what we'll do is we'll think about the entanglement of these systems if I have a topological insulator, let's say, and ask whether there's a signature in entanglement. Okay, so as all of you know, if I'm given a system, if I'm given the ground state of some system and I divide it into two parts, let's call it the left and the right, you can take the ground state wave function and extract from that a density matrix that's defined only on the right part of the system, for example, by tracing out all of the degrees of freedom on the left. And one reason why you might think there may be a signature of this topological insulator physics in entanglement, if you think about how these topological insulators differ from a trivial insulator, in a trivial insulator, in a garden variety insulator, which doesn't have any particularly interesting edge states, you can adiabatically change your system to a very simple cartoon picture where every electron is just sitting on one of the atomic nuclei. It's just sitting near an atomic nuclei. You have the right number of electrons so that every nucleus is occupied by some electron, and that gives you this band insulator. It's kind of a molecular picture of a band insulator where all of the electrons are strongly confined to the atoms. Okay, but in a topological insulator, the reason you get novel physics is, although it is an insulator, the electronic wave functions are extended. There's no way to adiabatically move from this topological insulator to this very simple picture where the electrons are stuck to a particular atom. Okay, so if you have this kind of extended wave functions and you cut the system, you expect that cut will reveal some entanglement and that will allow you to diagnose this topological phase. Okay, so at least at some level, you expect there should be a signature in entanglement. Question is, which particular measure of entanglement should you use to expose this physics? Okay, so of course, the favorite measure of entanglement for most people is to look at the entanglement entropy. Okay, you look at the entropy associated with this density matrix, the entanglement entropy. Okay, now, it turns out that for these type of topological phases, these integer topological phases, which don't have topological order, the entanglement entropy does not diagnose topological order, the topological insulators. And that only works for these fractional topological phases like the fractional quantum Hall effect, or more precisely things that have topological order in the sense that they have ground state degeneracy on the torus, for example. Okay, so there's a well-known diagnostic of this kind of topology for these fractional phases using the entanglement entropy that's due to Kitaev, Preskill, and Levin and Wang. Okay, but that doesn't work in this particular case. The topology over here is weaker in some ways, and you need a different measure to extract this kind of distinction between phases. Yeah, and it turns out the appropriate tool, at least one appropriate tool that we have found to be useful, the appropriate tool is this entanglement spectrum that was introduced by Lee and Haldane in the context of fractional quantum Hall effect. Okay, so it turns out for the fractional quantum Hall effect, there are other ways of doing it, but for these topological insulators, this appears to be the only way to diagnose band topology in the ground state wave function. Okay, so the idea over here is you take your density matrix and write it as a sum of eigenvalues. And since these eigenvalues are non-negative, you can always write it as the exponential of some real number. And you call this real number the energies. Okay, these are, of course, not physical energies. We're just dealing with the ground state. These are some entanglement energies. And you can plot these eigenvalues, all of the different eigenvalues of this density matrix. And what will be useful for us is to actually realize that if you have an entanglement cut, like the one I had before, you have translation symmetry along the cut. Okay, so you can translate along the cut, and that's the symmetry of your system. And so you can label these eigenvalues by the momentum, okay, by the eigenvalues of the translation operator in the two directions that are parallel to the cut. Okay, so that's really this entanglement spectrum. You exhibit these eigenvalues of the density matrix as a function of the momentum. Okay, and what you can show, I don't really have time to show it in detail, but I can, I'm happy to discuss that later. At least for the case of non-interacting fermion phases, you can prove that if the physical edge of your system has some protected edge states, has edge states that really diagnose the bulk topology, then this entanglement spectrum will also have the same type of state. Okay, so you don't really need to take an edge, physical edge, and solve for all of the eigenvalues of your system. You can simply take the ground state, do this entanglement cut, look at the entanglement eigenvalues along this entanglement surface, and you'll get the same spectrum. Okay, and this proof is actually very simple, but let me just show you some numerical evidence for this. So we took a three-dimensional topological phase, and we cut it, really looked at the physical eigenvalues. And this is what you get for a physical surface. There's a single Dirac cone as a function of momentum. Okay, so this is momentum picked along a certain direction. Actually, a two-dimensional, there are two dimensions for the momentum, but I just pick one. This is the energy. This is the physical energy. You find that there is some Dirac point. Okay, now if you do the same for the entanglement spectrum, so these things are really these eigenvalues, this is, again, momentum along the cut. You also see that there's a Dirac point. Okay, so in this particular case, this diagnoses the surface states, simply given the ground state wave function.
So the fact that you have some sort of particle hole symmetry, is it an accident?
Or? Yeah, it's a very good observation. So it turns out that, yeah, if you look at the Dirac point over here, it's exactly at zero. Whereas over here, it's not, right? So it turns out that that'll be the next point that I'll make. Let me sort of finish that and get back to your question.
The left-hand graph, that's the surface state?
That's
the surface state,
yes.
And the right-hand is the
bulk
state?
That's right.
This is in 3D.
3D, yeah. So this is a two-dimensional surface of a three-dimensional system, yeah.
But you didn't take the log on the right-hand.
Yeah, you can if you want.
I mean, the symmetry will be broken. The particle hole symmetry that you see, yeah.
You're writing this as a probability, and what you're finding is that the probability half guy is at is where the Dirac cone occurs. So anywhere you plot it, you'll see that. This is where the probability half occurs.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, but there is something special about the spectrum, which I'll get to in a minute.
This K here is the momentum of phi I.
Yeah, that's right.
So then K can be very large.
Yeah, so you're thinking about many particles giving you momentum. Yeah, okay, so that's a good point. So I kind of skipped over one point over here. So for free fermion phases, what you can do is when you look at these eigenvalues, this is actually the eigenvalue of some many-body Hamiltonian, entanglement Hamiltonian, but many-body Hamiltonian. And as is true for any free particle phase, you can build it up if you know the eigenvalues of the free particles. You just occupy different numbers of states. So what I plot over here is simply the eigenvalues for the single particle spectrum. And the Schmidt ground state, for example, will be got by filling up all of these guys. So it's a good question to ask what happens in the many-body spectrum. What does the Z state look like? There will be some feature, of course. But it's not as clear as in this case. Yeah, so you can prove this. But you can ask the following question, actually, which was sort of the converse question. I know that anytime I have a topological phase with unusual edge states, I'll see that in the entanglement spectrum. Okay, but what if I see something unusual in the entanglement spectrum? Okay, does it necessarily mean that the surface states in the physical system also has unusual surface states? Okay, so that's the converse question. And it turns out you can do this little numerical experiment. You can take this phase that we had before, this topological insulator, and what I told you is that it's protected by time reversal symmetry, right? So you can break time reversal symmetry in that model, and you can plot the physical surface spectrum. Okay, and what you see is that the spectrum now has a gap at the surface. The Dirac cone that you had before, which was the characteristic signature of a topological surface state, disappears, and you have this energy gap. It's a massive Dirac cone, if you like. Once you have a spectrum like this on the surface, you can make adiabatic changes and pull this thing down, pull that up, and you can completely destroy the surface state. So this is adiabatically connected to a trivial insulator, which has no surface state at all. Okay, but if you look at the entanglement spectrum for the same, the ground state of the same system, you see that this Dirac cone is still there. It turns out there are other subtle changes in this entanglement spectrum that was pointed out by Bernoulli and collaborators. How this thing connects to the bulk bands is different. But if you simply focus on this Dirac point, it's still there. Again, that's related to this question about the particle symmetry in this case. So this entanglement spectrum still seems to have a Dirac cone that's sitting at that point. And it turns out this is due to a different symmetry, which also happened to be in our model. This is inversion symmetry. Okay, so if you take a point inside your solid to minus of itself, take a coordinate r to minus r, that's inversion. And it turns out that the system we started out with has inversion symmetry. Okay, and that can give you a protection over and above this time reversal symmetry.
So you say it again, it has inversion symmetry or not? You
have it has inversion symmetry. Yes. Now the thing is that if you make a physical surface always breaks inversion symmetry because there's an outside and inside. So you don't see, so there is some topology that is connected to the inversion symmetry over here, but it's not exposed by a physical surface state. Okay, so all of the different symmetries that people use to define the well-known topological insulators, those are internal symmetries, like time reversal, things like that, which are unaffected whether or not you have an edge. Okay, so in those cases, when you are protected by such symmetries, if you look at an edge, the symmetry is still preserved and you see these gapless edge states. But if you have a topological phase protected by inversion symmetry, you don't see that when you actually make a physical edge, okay, because the edge breaks the symmetry. But interestingly, the entanglement cut doesn't really break symmetry, right? When you make an entanglement cut between the regions A and B, it's sort of a virtual cut. And you could imagine that inversion is somehow retained after you make this cut. Okay, and it turns out that inversion actually, so you know, you can make this test, you can break inversion, and then you see that there's a little gap that opens up. Okay, so you can convince yourself that indeed it's inversion that's protecting this. And let me just briefly mention the way in which inversion ends up protecting this Dirac point. It turns out the way inversion acts on your entanglement states, you know, unlike most symmetries that will act in a unitary fashion, because you interchange the regions A and B when you do this inversion, it turns out that inversion acts in an anti-unitary, is applied as an anti-unitary operator. In fact, it looks a lot like time reversal symmetry, it squares to minus one. Okay, so so when you have this entanglement cut, inversion actually is an anti-unitary operator.
Yeah. I just didn't understand. By inversion, you mean reflection? What do you mean?
Yeah, you can think of it as reflection also if you want. Inversion is taking the point r to minus r.
Oh,
it's
parity.
Yeah.
So why would that? So if you were in the center of a if you had a spherical boundary, you'd still preserve that inversion.
Yeah, but not near the surface, right? So the point of inversion might be the center, but if I have some surface like this, maybe down there somewhere you have inversion, but that, if you do inversion with this point, you'll take the surface and map it to some different surface. So you'll end up relating the properties of two different surfaces. Whereas with time reversal symmetry, you know, if you have time reversal symmetry, it doesn't really change the location of your system. So an edge does not break time reversal symmetry. Okay, but if you think of an entanglement cut,
you mean you want inversion symmetry about every point, not just about one point.
So let's think of some general symmetry. If you want to see the surface states, you need that symmetry acting so that the surface is left invariant. So, for example, if you had reflection symmetry, let's say I was having something protected by reflection symmetry, it's possible that reflection, this surface is invariant under some reflection symmetry. In that case, this particular surface would show you unusual surface states.
It has to be a local symmetry at the
surface? The surface should be invariant under the symmetry.
But suppose you have a sphere, the surface is invariant under inversion in the origin.
That's right, yeah.
But that's not good enough.
That's not good enough, yeah, yeah. So for example,
what's the difference? Is it with the center of the symmetry, it has to be somehow local on the surface?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. The point that's left invariant should be on your surface, or the points that are left invariant. For something like time reversal symmetry, the whole thing is left invariant. So the reason your entanglement cut can get away with this is because when you do inversion, you interchange these two systems. So if you think about making a Schmidt decomposition of your ground state, you you have some states I and A and I and B. So under inversion, you map this state into that. So that actually you can recover from. There's a way to sort of get the mapping back to A. So when you have an inversion operation, you go from here to there. But you can use the Schmidt decomposition to come back to your original system, come back to system A. But the price you pay is that this operation, this inversion operation, becomes anti-unitary. And so we know that, you know, if you have some unitary operator, you just have a single unitary operator, it doesn't give you any degeneracies, right? You only need, you have some, you need some non-abelian group to get a degeneracy.
This reflection could be unitary or could be anti-unitary. You're saying in some cases it's anti-unitary.
So normally reflection is a unitary symmetry. But the way it acts on the Schmidt states is as an anti-unitary symmetry. Because what happens is that your, you know, most of the symmetry operators will take this to some other state, let's say I prime A. Okay, that would be a unitary symmetry. But here what's happening is that you're going from A to B. Okay, and that changes what this particular operator is.
So it's always anti-unitary?
Yeah, that's right.
When it's
realized in this way, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so it turns out that for gap phases, if you have things that are decaying rapidly enough, it doesn't matter that whether you're exactly in the middle or a little bit to the side. It's true that, you know, you have some small breaking of inversion, but that'll be exponentially small in this, you know, for example, let's say I move it by one lattice unit to the left. It'll be exponentially small in this one lattice unit times the correlation length, divided by the correlation length. It'll be down by the distance to this edge that actually breaks the time reversal symmetry divided by correlation length, the exponential of that. Yeah, so, you know, for any practical purpose, it's as long as, you know, you have, this is part of some inversion symmetric Hamiltonian, the precise geometry doesn't matter. Yeah. No, the cut, for this entanglement cut, it goes through the bulk of your system.
It has to go through the edge,
yeah.
Right.
It's not the edge. You could even have periodic boundary conditions.
But like the previous person who asked, you know, you cut through the sphere, presumably, you know, you can't have the edge outside the cut. I mean,
No, that question is quite different. That was about the physical surface states. So this is a question of whether the physical surface states will survive if you have something like a sphere which is overall inversion symmetric, and it doesn't. Yeah, in fact, you know, the simplest case to consider is to have no edge at all. Take like a torus. Take a three-dimensional torus for the system. And then divide it into two pieces, and then look at the entanglement spectrum. So the only thing you get from this thing is what you have at the surfaces of this entanglement cut. Yeah.
Does it make sense just to cut the system in a different way? Say, you consider the edge states, the two say surfaces, as system A and system B the rest.
Does
that make sense?
So you want to actually take a physical system which has a surface,
yes,
and then you want to make an entanglement cut?
Yeah, on the surface. Yes.
You just want to do that?
Yes. Let's say you can catch the two surfaces, say H states on one surface, H states on one surface, on the other surface, and you call A. This is your system.
Yeah, so you can certainly make any entanglement cut that you want, but if you want to diagnose this phase, you are much better off cutting it in the bulk.
Of course.
Because here you'll be, you know, you'll be exploring some physics of the surface state itself. So I've not really thought about this particular case, also because there are many low energy excitations over here. So there are many different ground states with almost the same energy. It may actually depend on which particular one you pick. But you know, if I cut it somewhere deep inside over here, it doesn't really matter what's going on at the surfaces. And but nevertheless, this entanglement spectrum can tell you that there are actually surface states. That's right. Yeah. So you're saying anywhere you would see the same physics, but yeah, that's right. Yeah. But as you approach the surface itself, you'll have other states that start coming up. Yeah. Okay. So. So all of the phases we talked about so far, they were really free fermion topological phases. And for all of these things, band theory works very well. So people can actually predict which materials have them. And apparently those predictions are very good because when the experimentalists look at these materials, they actually see these predicted surface states. Okay, so as one of my colleagues was joking, can we go beyond the bandwagon? Right. Can we go and talk about things that are not described by band theory? And the reason you might want to do that is the bandwagon is pretty crowded. Right? There are lots of people who are now working on these free fermion topological phases, and that's roughly what the field looks like at the moment. Okay, so we want to talk about interaction effects. Interacting topological phases, what happens when we have strong interactions? Can we get some new physics? Okay, and of course, people have thought about this question in the context of the quantum Hall effect. So of course, we have integer quantum Hall effect, which is the kind of phases we've been talking about so far. Bulk is trivial, but you have these protected edge states. Okay, so if you look at systems which have strong interactions, it turns out you end up getting the fractional quantum Hall effect. Okay, and this is usually what people think about when you say that there are interactions. So people have generalized the topological insulators to fractional topological insulators and so on. Okay, but these phases are extremely different from these integer quantum Hall states. Okay, and it's somewhat of a coincidence that they occur in the same context. The bulk is non-trivial, like we said. They have all of these topological excitations in the bulk, which are unusual and don't look like the original particles in your system. Okay, so the question is there some space in between? Okay, are there phases that require interactions in order to occur, but the interactions are not such that you end up in these fractional topological phases? Okay, that would really be the interacting generalization of these integer quantum Hall states and the topological insulators. Okay, so is there something in between? One might wonder, is there some, so that's why I'll use the word integer over here. There's some interacting but still integer topological phases with the restriction that there are no fractional excitations in the bulk, but they have non-trivial edge states. Okay, but nevertheless, the interactions are going to be essential. You can't define these in the absence of interactions. Okay, so one way to phrase this problem is, can you get topological phases for bosons? Okay, so bosons, of course, they're completely trivial without interactions. They all just Bose condense. So you need interactions to get non-trivial bosonic phases. Can you get a non-trivial topological phase of bosons, but which nevertheless are not like the fractional quantum Hall effect? Okay, so people have, of course, constructed phases of bosons that have fractional statistics and so on. We don't want those. We really want phases where in the bulk, the excitations are just bosons or collections of bosons. Okay, so do they exist? Do such phases exist? And we know at least one example of such a phase for a long time, and this is the Haldane chain. Okay, so in one dimension, if you take spin one objects, so spins and bosons I'll kind of use interchangeably. You can think of a spin as something that where the different states of the spin are different occupations of bosons. Okay, so in the Haldane chain of spin one spins, you couple them together in an antiferromagnetic way, but you realize that at the edge, you have an unusual excitation, you have a spin a half. Okay, and you can just get this by forming singlets of the spin ones. There's a spin a half left over at the edge. So even in a world where you only had spin one spins or integer spins, you could have this kind of phase and you would end up seeing a spin a half excitation. Okay, so that is the unusual thing of the Haldane chain. But the question is, do they have generalizations in higher dimensions? For example, in two dimensions, are there such phases of bosons or of spins where there are unusual edge states? Yeah, in fact, recently people have come up with some examples. So Kitav has a very nice example of such a phase, which has no symmetry. It doesn't require any symmetry to be protected. And there's very nice work by Xiaogang Wen and his group, where they've actually used symmetry, thinking about phases topological phases protected by symmetry, and they've achieved a complete classification of such phases according to this this work, using this cohomology. Yeah.
I thought this last classification in the projective groups,
it works for 1B. Yeah, so there are maybe two references over here. So there's an earlier work of theirs where they classified all possible topological phases in one dimension, and you're right, the result is the number of phases is equal to the number of projective representations of the group. There's a more recent work, I think maybe going back to about 9 months or so, same set of authors, I think, in the same order as well, where they have extended this physics to higher dimensions. And the extension is very natural. The projective representations are the second cohomology group. And for 2D, they say it's the third cohomology group, and for 3D, it's the fourth cohomology group. And to some extent, it's a conjecture, but as I'll show you, there's a completely independent approach that exactly verifies all of their predictions. So it's very likely to be correct, at least for bosonic phases. Yeah, so here I'll ask the same question, but I'll approach it in a different way. Mainly because I have no idea how to do this cohomology classification. So we'll use a more kind of physicist approach, use a sort of field theory approach, a Chern-Simons approach, and try to figure out what are the different phases that we have subject to the restrictions that I mentioned above. That it's built of bosons, and the bulk, the only excitations are the regular bosons. Okay, so rather than telling you exactly how we did this, let me give you some examples of the results. So those of you who are not interested how this was done, you can tune out in the next couple of slides. But let me tell you what we found from this method, which is actually consistent with some of the earlier work in terms of the number of phases that we found. Okay, so we can start with, again, bosons, but with no symmetry whatsoever. So we're not going to require any symmetry. So this is a bit like a topological superconductor, okay, for fermions. In topological superconductors, you don't demand any symmetry. Okay, so the question you can ask is, are there bosonic analogs of topological superconductors? Yeah, and it turns out that indeed you do find some non-trivial phase. I'll describe its properties in a second. And then you can look at topological phases with different symmetries. For example, if charge is conserved, okay, that's really the analog of the integer quantum Hall effect. Or if you have both time reversal symmetry and the charge conserved, okay, that's the analog of the quantum spin Hall or these topological insulators that we talked about. Okay, so what are these states that you find? So for this particular case with no symmetry, you find that there is a non-trivial topological phase of bosons. And if you want to describe its essential property is that it has an edge state, which is a chiral edge. Okay, so you have particles that move only along one direction at the edge. And this is something we're familiar with, of course, in the context of the integer quantum Hall effect. Okay, we said that the first non-trivial phase of the integer quantum Hall effect has one mode moving along the edge. Okay, so it turns out that with just one mode, you cannot support a phase of bosons without some kind of topological order, okay, without having fractional excitations in the bulk. With two also, you cannot, and so on. The minimum that you require is 8. Okay, and this result was known before to Kitav, and he called this the E8 state. Okay, we also find it within our classification. Okay, so you can have these sort of chiral edge states for bosons, but they have to be multiples of 8. You can also look at this particular case, and this is what Senthil and Michael Levin have done some very nice work on this particular state. Let me just mention briefly some of its property. When you have charge conserved, this is an analog of the integer quantum Hall effect. Okay, and it was known from the earlier cohomology classification, there are non-trivial phases with this particular symmetry. Okay, but it wasn't known exactly what their physical properties are. Okay, so that's an advantage of this Chern-Simons theory that I'll talk about. You immediately know all of the physical properties. And the main physical property of this state is that it has a quantized Hall conductance, although the edge state actually has a pair of edge states that move in opposite directions. It's a non-chiral edge. Normally, you would think that they would gap out, but it turns out that's protected by this charge conservation symmetry. Yeah, so just like the integer quantum Hall effect of fermions, you also have a quantized Hall conductance. But the surprise is that this Hall conductance is always an even integer. Okay, so so that turns out to be a restriction that you require for bosons, and I'm sure Senthil will talk more about that and the realizations of that phase. Okay, finally, you can look at this case where you have the same symmetries as a topological insulator, and again, you find a non-trivial phase, okay, which has oppositely propagating edge modes, and that's very surprising because we always thought that with this particular symmetry class, it's important that time reversal squares to minus one, okay, like the Kramer's kind of time reversal to protect the edge states. Nevertheless, for this bosonic phase, although this time reversal is the regular time reversal on bosons, you end up getting these protected edge states. Okay, so I guess I have a few minutes or 10 minutes, okay. So let me very briefly tell you how one ends up getting such results, at least one way to get these results, using this Chern-Simons approach. Okay, so very briefly, this Chern-Simons approach is a way in which people have been describing abelian quantum Hall states, where you think about, you have certain densities and currents of particles, and you represent those, the density of particles, for example, by some gauge flux. Okay, so curl of some vector potential is this gauge flux. This vector potential is some emergent field that you use to keep track of the densities and currents in your problem. Okay, and so this is a typical Chern-Simons theory that you write down. It's A dot curl of A. I'm using this three vector notation for space and time. And this constant over here, this K, if it's one, that's the integer quantum Hall effect of fermions. Okay, and if it's three, for example, that's the Laughlin state. The Laughlin one-third state is represented by K equal to three. Now, for more general phases, it turns out that this K is actually a matrix. It's a symmetric matrix which has integer entries. And if you want to describe a phase of bosons like we are interested, there are certain restrictions that you place on this matrix. There are three restrictions. Let me very briefly say all of them. You have to have even integer diagonals. The determinant of this matrix tells you the ground state degeneracy on the torus. Okay, so for example, in the integer quantum Hall effect where K is one, of course, the determinant of this number is just the number itself. Determinant K is simply the number of ground states. It's just one ground state on the torus. Okay, but for the Laughlin state, where this K is three, you have more ground states. That's the topological order. Okay, so if you don't have any topological order, no ground state degeneracy on the torus, this determinant K had better be one. Okay, that's, we're going to demand that. And finally, this the signature of this matrix, number of positive eigenvalues minus number of negative eigenvalues, that tells you the direction of motion of your edge states. Okay, the number of positive ones are right movers, number of negative ones are left movers. Okay, so those are the basic facts you need to know about this K matrix. Okay, so for example, this the first example we talked about, we want to construct a bosonic K matrix, so even entries on the diagonal, which has determinant equal to one. Okay, and also you expect that this is going to be a chiral state. If you have no symmetry to protect it, all of the edge states should move in the same direction. So you ask that all of the eigenvalues, say, are positive. Okay, so you want a particular integer symmetric matrix that satisfies these conditions. Okay, so you can Google this question and you'll find on Wikipedia, you'll find an answer. Apparently there's this matrix and this is the smallest matrix that can do that. It has all integer, even integer diagonals. Determinant of this matrix is one. Okay, and it turns out for people who know group theory, this is a well-known matrix. It's related to this E8 group. Okay, so what you conclude is that in the absence of symmetry, you need at least eight edge chiral edge modes, and this gives you a representation of the phase, the non-trivial phase, which turns out to be identical to what was obtained by Kitaev, but by some completely different procedure. We Googled, yes. Yeah, yeah. So one of the ingredients in the procedure is to Google for this answer. So it turns out you have to phrase the question slightly differently to be able to Google it. So it turns out there's a you can map this to some problem in crystallography about in which dimension you can find a crystal of a certain type. So this K matrix is related to the inner product of unit vectors. So you can ask, once you phrase it as a crystallography question, you can easily Google it. And this turns it turns out in 8 dimensions, a particular kind of crystal lattice which has special properties, which is what we want. Yeah, but I'm sure Kitav didn't do it by Googling anything. So that counts as a different method. Okay, so the next case you can look at is, what if you have some symmetry? Okay, what if you have charge conservation symmetry? And now it turns out that you can do this with just a 2x2 K matrix, which has the form of the Pauli matrix, sigma x, and the usual representation. And that's what this topological field theory looks like. Okay, there are two of these vector potentials that have this term, but they're charged, so they couple to an external electromagnetic field, and there's some coefficient n that tells you how they couple. Okay, and if you work out the properties of the state, and I'll let Senthil tell you more details about the state, it has an even integer Hall conductance. Okay, so this is really an integer quantum Hall state of bosons. Okay, and you can continue, you can incorporate gentle symmetries, and that's mainly what we did in our work. We found a way to incorporate gentle symmetry into this K matrix formulation. Okay, and then you can really look at all the different phases that you find. It's very similar to actually classifying different kinds of crystals you might get. Even in the way in which it's done, it's very similar to this crystal classification. There's one additional step, which is checking for edge states. And we get some table, depending on what symmetry you have a different list of topological phases. And for all of these things that we checked, some point we ran out of steam, but all of these that we checked, it agreed with this cohomology classification. Okay, so we think this is an independent check of that classification. Okay, since I'm out of time, almost out of time, let me just summarize. So really what we've been seeing in the last few years is that there are new states in solids where the distinction is really at the level of topology. Okay, and I think this is really a new theme in solid state physics, many exciting things to do. And it appears that entanglement may be quite useful, at least the cases we know, it seems to be quite useful as a kind of order parameter to distinguish these phases. Okay, and let me just leave these acknowledgement slides up. So the work on the interacting topological phases is done with Yanming Liu, very talented postdoc now at UC Berkeley, but I also collaborated with Frankie Zhang and Ari Turner on the entanglement related physics that I talked about before. Frank was a student at Berkeley, is now moving to Stanford as a postdoc. Ari is a faculty member at the University of Amsterdam.
So you had you described how to diagnose certain how to look at the entanglement entropy, the entanglement spectrum, and find out about the spectrum in the presence of an edge.
Right.
But then there was some issue there. So in practice, can you use that the entanglement spectrum as a diagnose?
Yeah. So what we found is that the entanglement spectrum is more powerful than a surface state in diagnosing topological phases.
Oh, that's your conclusion.
That was the conclusion. So for example, for inversion symmetric insulators, if you were to just look at surface states, you wouldn't find them. But there is something topological about them. For example, the electromagnetic response could be topological.
Okay. So there is something physical that is...
That's being captured, yeah.
And you detected
yeah. So the simplest way of diagnosing topological phases is look for surface states, and it doesn't work for inversion symmetric insulators. So we actually use this procedure, this entanglement spectrum, to classify all the inversion symmetric topological insulators. So at the end of the day, of course, you may not have needed that, but we could do many toy examples, look at the entanglement spectrum, see if they have surface states or not. And even now, the simplest way to classify is using the entanglement spectrum. And we use that to predict some new phase that and some material that might be in that phase.
And if you look at the entanglement spectrum, can you distinguish between different phases which are topological?
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
So how do they look different?
So for example, one simple difference is the number of band touchings. And there are others where you see there's a line, there may be a line of extended range of momenta where you have some degeneracy of the spectrum. So there are different topological phases that you can classify using that.
Yeah, the question on more or less the same thing. I think you told us that if there's an interesting edge state, then it will, or surface state, it'll show up in the entanglement spectrum, but the converse might not be true.
That's right.
But you also told us that there was a simple proof of the first physics then.
Right.
But you didn't tell us. So.
Yeah, I can tell you, I can sketch the proof.
Yeah, can you sketch the proof?
Razor somewhere. Okay, maybe I'll just sketch the proof over here. So let's say you have some topological phase with some band insulator topological phase. So you have all of these bands filled and all of those empty. Yeah, and if I look at the physical surface of such a system, it has some particular surface state which diagnoses the topology of the system. Right, and let's say this is, for example, protected by time reversal symmetry or something like that, where the physical surface actually has some surface states. So now let's look at the entanglement spectrum. So it turns out you can think of the entanglement spectrum as being identical to some physical spectrum for a particular band structure. And the particular band structure is to take this, what you had for this physical system, take the band that you had and completely flatten it. Okay, so this is energy. What you do is you retain the wave functions of all of the filled states, but you ignore the dispersion that you would have in the physical band structure. Anything that's below the energy gap, you say that it has energy, let's say minus one. Anything above, it doesn't really matter what is above. You just flatten the bands that are filled. So it turns out that the edge state of this flattened band Hamiltonian is the entanglement spectrum. And the reason why this has exactly the same kind of protected surface state as the initial state is because you can go from here to there simply by taking this dispersion and flattening it, which is a smooth deformation of this original state.
But when you say the edge state of that is the entanglement spectrum, you mean its dispersion relation looks like the...
That's right, yeah.
You can get when you plot the entanglements.
That's right. There's a monotonic, there's some function of this that will map it into the entanglement spectrum. Okay, now I want to prove this result. This is the key result. So the basic idea is that when you look at, if you want to find the entanglement spectrum, you have some, you're writing the density matrix, you're writing this density matrix on the region A as the exponential of some operator. So if I look at correlation functions in this region A, let's say I take some correlation functions of operators in this region A. So this correlation function, all of the information of this correlation function can be obtained from this density matrix. Right? It's just sitting inside the region A. Okay, and if you expand what this correlation, so if you know these correlation functions, you can figure out what the entanglement Hamiltonian is. Right? So if you have a free theory,
are you assuming some sort of Gaussian?
That's right. This is only for free fermions. This proof only works for free fermions. Yeah, so if I know the expectation value of this operator, I know the Hamiltonian.
Right.
And this expectation value only depends on the filled bands. Right. So you can expand this fermion operator in terms of the band basis, in terms of these eigenstates. And this will pick up an expectation value only when you have an overlap with the state that's filled. So essentially what this expectation value gives you, it gives you one if you're in this the filled band, irrespective of which particular state you're looking at. So from that, you can argue that, in fact, what you're looking at is simply this flattened Hamiltonian. So it really maps to the physical edge state of a particular Hamiltonian, which has the same topology as the original one. But now you can see why this might contain more information, right? Because it's a particular Hamiltonian. So it may actually have more information than some generic dispersion. It always has the topology of this, but it could have a little bit more. And you know, that little bit more we kind of exploit for this inversion symmetric case.
Can you just repeat the keys? How did the edge get in? You talked about the correlation function and so on. If we know the correlation function, then we can get...
Yeah, then you can get the edge, the entanglement Hamiltonian.
And the edge get into this.
So then you simply look at the physical edge of such a Hamiltonian, and that is the entanglement spectrum. So the eigenvalues are going to be exponentiated compared to that, but all of the wave functions are going to be the same. So you know, since our intuition works better for real physical systems, You can take this entanglement problem and map it to a particular physical, the edge state of a particular physical system. You can ask, what is that physical system? The physical system is exactly the same as whatever you had before, except that the dispersion of the filled bands is flat. And you can prove that statement.
Can you prove the bounds this argument with?
Yeah, it's like a two-line proof, literally, yeah.
That's a two-line proof. Can you give the two-line?
Yeah, it's two non-trivial lines. Yeah, it's in our paper. But you can kind of see it, right? You can see that for free fermions, it's all related to the correlation function, which only involves the filled states.
I had one other question.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got this correspondence between the group cohomology analysis and this K matrix and the Chern-Simons.
Right.
It can't be a miracle. I mean, if it's general, shouldn't there be some way of seeing why they had to give the same, even maybe just purely mathematically, that the two mathematical problems map into each other?
So that's not been done yet. I think Senthil will talk a bit about that, connecting, trying to connect these two approaches. But anyway, here's something in his paper. But as of now, these are two completely independent methods, and you know, given that they give exactly the same answer with so many different cases, of course, there's got to be some connection. It's not apparent, though.
Okay. Let's thank our speaker again.